I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea. I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we're going to be talking about a really important battle at the end of World War II, one that helped to, I think, seal Germany's fate, but maybe was not such a foregone conclusion as we all now seem to think, looking way back 80 years later. I'm talking about the Battle of the Bulge. And for that conversation, I'm joined by my old friend, personal friend, and a good, of course, old friend of the Ashbrook Center, and occasional host of this very podcast, Professor John Mosier. Listeners know him. He is chair of the Department of History and Political Science at Ashland University, where he teaches courses in European and American history, in particular, a wonderful World War II course. He's a prolific author, including writing books on World War II, the Great Depression, and the coming of World War II, and source books, a collection of primary documents on World War II. So John knows what he's talking about. Don't be fooled. He really does. And smarter than I look. John, delighted to have you with us.
Thank you, Jeff. I am delighted to be here.
The Battle of the Bulge. I think the title suggests a shape.
Yes.
I can't remember another battle named after a shape. Take us back 80 years ago. What's the situation in Western Europe during World War II where this takes place?
Yeah, so it takes place at a location that had been fought over once before in World War II. It's the Ardennes, really the same territory that the Germans used to punch a massive hole in Allied lines in the spring of 1940 that led to the fall of France. It's a heavily forested region, also quite hilly. The rap on it in 1940 was that it was unsuitable for tanks, so the Germans would never choose to go through there. Not only did they choose to go through successfully in 1940, but they did it again at the end of 1944, not as successfully, but it was not entirely clear at the outset that it would be unsuccessful.
This battle has always been talked about as being surprising, because it looks like by the end of 1944, of course, our listeners know this, but D-Day has happened in June of 1944. Eventually, the Allies are able to punch out from Normandy and move toward Germany. Operation Market Garden has happened, not succeeded, but it does look like, despite that big setback, the Allies are on the march to Berlin, the Russians coming from the east, the Americans, British, French from the west. It looks like it's just now a matter of mopping up. Is that the general opinion of the Allies at that time?
It was. There was a tremendous amount of complacency on the part of the Western Allies, and this is why the offensive had as much success as it did. After a few weeks of hard fighting after Normandy, after the breakout, almost all of France was liberated fairly quickly, and the Allies had reached about as far as they thought they could go until the thaw, right? They were going to settle down. Almost all of France was in Allied hands, but they were going to hang out for a few months, and then when they could resume, they'd keep going. Because the big problem on the Allied side was the last few months had been so successful, with the prominent exception of Market Garden, that the Allies had really run beyond their supply lines. So they had to stop. The Allied forces were running short of fuel, ammunition, just about everything else. So this gave the Germans the opportunity to strike back.
What's the situation? I know this is in the Western theater, but at this time in the East, obviously there are military and political calculations. People like Eisenhower and FDR and Churchill are thinking about getting to Berlin as quickly as they can because the Russians are advancing. What's the situation at the end of 44 on the Eastern Front?
Well, in the mid to late 1944, the Soviets had launched Operation Bagration, which completely destroyed a German army group. And Hitler was far more worried about the Soviets than he was about the British and the Americans. He believed that if he could, for the moment, the Eastern Front was calm, but he knew that wasn't going to stay that way very long. He was able to direct a significant amount of forces from the east to the west to engage in this last-ditch desperate campaign that he hoped would force the British and the Americans to conclude a separate peace that would allow him to then throw everything he had back against the Russians. This was really the hopeless aspect of it. The thought that, I mean, all the way to the end of the war, Hitler was nursing this idea that because the relationship between the British and the Americans on the one side and the Soviets on the other side was so odd in so many ways, that there was always a chance that he could break down the alliance and get a separate peace with one side or the other. It was a complete fantasy in his
part. So the Germans shifted, and is it largely on Hitler's orders that they shift divisions from the east to the west, thinking if we push back, we can stall them and get them to sue for a separate peace? This Hitler's strategy?
Yeah. So what he hoped to do was drive again through the Ardennes, where the German army had had so much success in 1940. Just like in 1940, the Allies regarded it, the Ardennes, as a quiet area. They were putting units there to recover and to rest, and they put inexperienced forces there for further training. The thought is they're not, first of all, the Allies are convinced that the Germans are no longer capable of a major offensive. And if they were, it wasn't going to be here. So the thought was, we're going to burst through the Allied lines in the Ardennes and then head north, ultimately to capture the Belgian port of Antwerp. Antwerp was critically important. It was it had only been captured a few months before, and it was, if it could be gotten up and running, it would be a major entry point for supplies, for Allied supplies in the continent. If Antwerp could be taken, not only would it interfere with that, but it would drive a wedge between British forces that were sort of to the east of Antwerp and U.S. forces that were to the south and west. If he could cut them off from one another and take Antwerp and leave a whole bunch of Allied units behind German lines, that would give him the leverage he needed to get a negotiated peace out of the British and the Americans.
What do we know, if anything, about the response of the German generals and high command to this, what seems like, extremely risky move?
Well, they thought it was highly ambitious. They thought it was borderline madness. But there's never a good time to disobey Hitler. But in the months after the July 20th assassination attempt, it was particularly bad because Hitler deeply distrusted the upper ranks of the German army. And in fact, in the wake of the assassination attempt, he had gone after a bunch of generals, dismissing them, or worse, if he had any reason to question their loyalty. One of the two generals who was very much involved in the planning was Walter Model. He was a fanatical Nazi. Hitler could trust him. Model was called the Führer's fireman. Hitler would throw him into particularly difficult spots, and he had a history of always getting German forces out of them. The other was General Gerd von Rundstedt, who did not enjoy a close relationship with Hitler, and Hitler deeply distrusted him, and Rundstedt was not about to do anything that might give Hitler an excuse to get rid of him.
So how did the Germans plan this attack? Because, of course, the Allies, I think by this time in the war, it's fair to say they have almost complete air superiority. Right. There's relentless daytime, nighttime bombing of Germany. Presumably, Allied spy planes are all over the place. They have some help from resistance forces, certainly in France at least. How were the Germans able to move forces around to position them for this kind of an attack?
Yeah, that's really amazing, especially when you add to it the fact that the German codes had been broken and all kinds of messages were intercepted and decoded. Yet code breakers never picked up on this, mainly because Hitler ordered radio silence about the operation. As for aerial reconnaissance, that's great when the weather is good enough for aircraft to fly. And it was not good in mid-December and even in the weeks leading up to it. But some of it goes back to this just plain complacency. There were some intelligence officers who suggested that the Germans, there was a lot of activity going on at this sector of the front, and it was dismissed. Omar Bradley, famous U.S. general, was warned about it, and there's going to be an attack in this zone, I think. And Bradley's response was, "Let them come." So under ordinary circumstances, all of these preparations would have been clear to the Allies, but not in this circumstance.
Was there also a perception, part of the complacency, that the German army in the West along those lines was old men and Hitler youth?
There was some of that. There was one very large unit of Hitler youth involved, and some units of the Volkskommandieren. These were boys and old men, and those who were frankly too sick or disabled to have been caught up in the draft up to this point. So they were hardly frontline troops. So the fact that it looked like Hitler was scraping the bottom of the barrel would play into this sense of complacency. At the same time, there were very battle-hardened and skilled units of the Waffen-SS that were assigned to this sector too.
So what happens, when does the attack actually happen? When does the Battle of the Bulge actually start? What happens on their first few surprise days?
Yeah, so December 16th is the date for the launch. The Germans have done have engaged in some skullduggery even before that, infiltrating German soldiers who can speak English so fluently, can speak like a native. They were sent to infiltrate behind the lines in uniforms and dog tags taken from dead GIs, and their job was to cause trouble wherever possible, changing road signs so that the units wouldn't know exactly where they had to go. So this played into this sense of confusion that reigned in the 16th when, contrary to all expectations, the Germans launch a massive attack, hundreds of thousands of troops, about 1,000 tanks. The idea that the Germans could get together 1,000 tanks at this point in the West was considered unlikely at best. And they immediately start making gains all along the front. And this is where the term bulge appears. Yeah, you're right in saying, I cannot think of a single other example of a battle in history that's named for the shape of the line that appears. Interestingly, it only seems to be the British and the Americans who call it the Battle of the Bulge. The French call it the Battle of the Ardennes. The Germans call it the Ardennes Offensive. The code name, or they refer to it by the German code name, which was Operation Wacht am Rhein, Watch on the Rhine. And by the way, that code name was even meant to be misleading, because if the Allies even heard, Operation Wacht am Rhein, that means you're just watching the Rhine. It doesn't mean you're actually launching an attack. But yeah, they were doing more than watching. So the first few days, there was a great deal of confusion. U.S. and some British forces falling back very rapidly. If it hadn't been for the very determined defense at certain critical points, the offensive probably would have succeeded more than it actually did. But for instance, the town of St. Viet, that was, according to the German plans, that was supposed to be captured by the end of the second day. So by the end of the 17th, that was supposed to be in German hands. As it turned out, that held out until the 21st, right? It still fell, but that was four critical days. Here's the thing with this operation. Every day counted. It had to proceed very quickly. For one thing, the Germans were going to rely very heavily on captured fuel and other supplies. This is another thing. The Germans were running low on practically.
Yeah, I was wondering that very thing. How do you have 1,000 tanks? How do you have fuel?
Yeah, exactly. Having the tanks alone is remarkable. But having the fuel at this stage of the war, when Germany had no external fuel supply, except for whatever synthetic oil they were able to produce, and whatever stockpiles they had. So they had enough to launch the invasion, but the understanding was they had to capture fuel depots on the Allied side in order to keep the offensive going. There was no way those tanks were going to get anywhere close to Antwerp without refueling and refueling at Allied expense. So any kind of delay was going to be bad for the Germans. For one thing, every day without capturing more fuel is one day closer to those tanks running to the empty line. The other thing was, when at some point the skies are going to be clear. Nobody knows, of course, when, but as soon as those skies are clear, Allied planes are going to take to the air. And by this point, the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, was almost non-existent, at least in the West, or the East for that matter. If German planes, whatever German planes were still around at the end of 1944, were being used to defend German cities from Allied bombing. So there was no way for the Germans to challenge Allied air supremacy, which is why they were counting on the terrible visibility of mid to late December to launch this attack so that the Allies couldn't fly.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
When the attack starts on the 16th and the Germans actually start making advances, the 16th, the 17th, and start pushing the bulge in the line, what's the reaction of the Allied military command?
Oops. George Patton, who was stationed to the southeast, went into action very quickly, got there within several days. But for a while, I mean, even just kind of organizing any kind of counterattack was time consuming, just because this operation was so unexpected. So it really was a matter of damage control for the first few days. Had it not been for the resistance at St. Vith and the better known resistance at the Belgian town of Bastogne, these were important because they were crossroads, and especially given the bad weather, and by the way, the bad weather affected the Germans as well as the Allies, the only way that they were going to move these forces is along roads. So having control of crossroads like St. Vith and Bastogne was critical. St. Vith fell, as I mentioned, fell 4 days after the Germans were supposed to take it. Bastogne never fell. Is the classic story of Tony McAuliffe, the general in command, surrounded by German forces. There's a message saying, you know, well, why don't you surrender and spare your troops unnecessary suffering? We have overwhelming force outside. McCullough's famous response was nuts. At least that's what the newspapers reported. It is highly likely that McAuliffe's comment was more colorful than that, but of course what you could print in the newspaper was limited, so nuts served the purpose.
I was wondering about that, because by the late 1944, the triumphalism, the complacency, and perhaps a sense of triumphalism on the home front, and then all of a sudden the newspapers get wind of this massive German attack on the line that's bulging out the lines and pushing toward places like Belgium. What's the reaction on the home front?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, on the home front, the American people are not getting a very complete picture of what's happening. Wartime censorship was significant. The newspapers, when it came to military affairs, printed what the army said they could print. So I don't know that the American people had any clear idea of how dicey the situation was. But it was only really dicey for a few days. It was pretty clear from early on that the Germans were not going to attain their objective. In fact, the Americans didn't even know what the objective was. They just know they're pushing through in an area where we weren't expecting them. And it was a bad time for the Allies. As I mentioned before, they were overextended. Their own supplies were limited, not as much as the German supplies were. So I don't know. My understanding is that the Battle of the Bulge didn't really lead to any general sense of gloom among the American people, because if it had been really that bad, they probably wouldn't have known about it.
You mentioned already the situation with Bastogne and the Americans who are surrounded there. There are other, I think, real stories and examples of heroism that sort of did slow down the advance enough to make it so it was never possibly going to reach its objective, even if it was already highly unlikely. Can you tell us any more about some of those important moments, some of those stories where we see the American military or the British military, the Allied military forces sort of, despite being pushed back, despite being surprised, fighting on a unit level and showing the kind of determination that we would see from them?
Yeah. I mean, Bastogne is the best example, because this was, again, a place that the Germans were supposed to capture very early on. It's the 101st Infantry is present here. It's almost entirely overwhelmed by the German forces outside. I don't remember exactly how many, but there were numerous Congressional Medal of Honor winners that came out of this battle for individual acts of heroism. One of them, and we talked about it on an episode of this, who just manned this machine gun, and when that machine gun ran out, he went to a neighboring machine gun, and it, all in bitter cold, just firing frantically as far as he could. And just holding back the Germans long enough until relief could come, and relief did come.
Yeah, talk about that. How long does the advance go for? The German advance go forward. How big does the bulge get? And then when did the Allies start really pushing back?
Yeah, so the bulge is dramatic. I mean, if you look at any map, you will see you will see why it's called the Battle of the Bulge. That sort of shoots out into southern Belgium and France. They get about as far as they're going to get by Christmas, and on Christmas the sky's clear. U.S. and British aircraft are in the skies again, and at that point, it's pretty much all over. It takes a few more weeks to mop up or to take back all the territory that the Germans had taken, but it was taken.
And is it a very bloody battle?
Oh yeah, it's horrendous. It for one thing, it's massive. About more than a million Allied troops were involved. About half of them were Americans. 19,000 soldiers were killed in action. Almost 48,000 were wounded and 23,000 were missing. On the German side, losses, of course, these are only estimates, 100,000 killed, wounded, or captured. So it really is a massive battle.
Yeah, I think those numbers are larger than what I thought. I mean, it really is one of the largest late battles of the war, at least on the Western Front.
Yeah, and in fact, Winston Churchill called this the greatest American battle of the war.
So this now, when the Americans start pushing back on Christmas Day and then rout the Germans back, I guess, to their original lines, do the Americans and the British keep pushing or do they stop? What becomes the war strategy after the battle?
Not right away, because even though they managed to prevent the Germans from breaking out of the trap they were in, that didn't resolve the basic problems that the Allies had at the end of the year, which is they had proceeded about as far as they could go in the supplies that they had. And this is this goes back to the relative few ports that they had under their control. Antwerp was the biggest, but even Antwerp could not be really used effectively, because to get to Antwerp from the English Channel involves going through a long river, for want of a better term, called the Scheldt Estuary. So this winding river goes from the English Channel to Antwerp, and the Germans controlled the east side of it. So any ships that tried to approach Antwerp were going to come under German fire. So Antwerp, theoretically, was a very important port, but it couldn't be used to anything like its full potential. Cherbourg by this time was in Allied hands, but the Germans fought to the last man in defending Cherbourg and destroyed all the port facilities. There were other French ports that were still in German hands at this point. So just the act of getting, so even though there were hundreds of thousands of Allied, over a million Allied soldiers on the continent of Europe, keeping them supplied was a huge problem. And it's why that after just cleaning up the bulge, there was another delay until the offensive could be resumed.
What effect did the Battle of the Bulge have militarily and politically on the course of the rest of the war?
It was no doubt Germany's last gasp on the Western Front. They could not mount another offensive like this again. So then they still had the Russians to worry about. So forces were being transferred to the east again, where the Soviets launched another offensive in early 1945. And that's the one that would end with the capture of Berlin. The course of the war in the West was considerably easier in early 1945 than it was in the East, mainly because the Germans were devoted to making the Russians fight for every square inch. The Russian casualties in the final months of the war were something like 10 times what the British and the Americans suffered. And the British and Americans, once they got their offensive going in early 1945, had a much easier time. Their biggest problem in 1945, after the Battle of the Bulge, was getting across the Rhine, which of course was and still is a very large river, and which Hitler blew all the ordered the that all the bridges be blown. One of them, Remagen, it was the one that got missed, but the Rhine was really the major obstacle to getting into Germany and, in fact, overrunning Western Germany.
So the loss of the Battle of the Bulge, what effect does it have on the German army, the German command, maybe even on Hitler himself? Do the German generals start saying, "Okay, the war really is lost. We need to pursue possibly another path," or do they double down and say, "Now we die to the last man, this is it"?
Yeah, this isn't entirely clear. I mean, at the time, German generals had to be very careful about what they said or what people heard them say. And often in getting a sense for what German generals believed, we go to their memoirs, but their memoirs were notorious for being self-exculpatory, just trying to avoid. They all tried to distance themselves from Hitler. They all made arguments like, well, you know, we knew his strategy was madness, but there was nothing we could do. But there is no evidence that the German soldiers stopped fighting. What held them back was lack of supplies, lack of fuel, lack of ammunition, and lack of numbers.
And on the Russian side, the Allied defeat of the battle of the Germans at the Battle of Bulge, does it have any effect on the relationship between Stalin and FDR and Churchill?
Yeah, the Yalta Conference takes place in February of 1945. At this point, the Battle of the Bulge, the date that's usually given to mark the end of it is January 25th. So it was in very recent memory. It was a subject of discussion. But there's no evidence that the result of the Battle of the Bulge affected the dynamic among the Allied leadership.
To your mind, if we're thinking about, I know you've studied this, a person that we should be thinking about for the Battle of the Bulge, the kind of an interesting story, call it a hero, just call it an interesting story for us for the Battle of the Bulge. What comes to your mind?
So Jose Mendoza Lopez was born in Mexico in 1910. He was orphaned when he was young. He went to Texas, lived with an uncle there. He briefly was a professional boxer and joined the Merchant Marine. And while he was in the Merchant Marine, he found out about the attack on Pearl Harbor, and then he enlisted in the U.S. Army. And he was 33 years old at the time of the Battle of the Bulge. He was attached to K Company, 23rd Infantry Regiment. He was a machine gunner. And ordinarily, machine guns, these were heavy machine guns. They were generally operated by teams of at least three. He didn't have his team with him. He acted alone. He operated this heavy tripod mount machine gun. Fortunately, he had plenty of ammunition on hand, and held off. By the way, he moved the machine gun. One of the reasons why it was manned by a crew was that these things were really heavy. So
right.
He would move from one location to another with this tripod mounted machine gun and the ammunition that was required to feed it, and was able to hold off the German forces long enough to allow the rest of his company to withdraw to a more advantageous position. So this was in Krinkelt, Belgium. He awarded the Medal of Honor, and that was presented to him in June of 1945.
That's an amazing story. I'm sure there are many, as you say, a high number of Congressional Medal of Honor winners out of this battle. Stories of individual heroism, really impressive. John, for our listeners, do you have any books or TV shows or movies that you recommend that help us understand the Battle of the Bulge or the Western Front sort of in the late parts of 1944 and the early parts of 1945?
There's a book by Anthony Beaver. He's a popular historian who's written on many campaigns during the war, called Ardennes 1944, The Battle of the Bulge. Alex Kershaw is one of my favorite popular military historians. He wrote a book called The Longest Winter. Stephen Ambrose has written on the subject. I'm forgetting the title of his book on the subject. There are a ton of books on the Battle of the Bulge. It's one of the most written about campaigns of the war.
So, John, if you're thinking about some for our listeners who want to just know more about the Battle of the Bulge, thinking about movies, thinking about TV shows, what further viewing or listening do you recommend?
Yeah. In terms of visual media, There was a movie made in 1965 simply called Battle of the Bulge. Henry Fonda was the star. It's, to be honest, not very good. But if you want something really better, it's not a movie length, but it is an episode of the Band of Brothers series devoted to Bastogne, which I would recommend over the Battle of the Bulge movie from 1965 any day.
Good. Thank you. John, again, thanks for taking the time to be with us on The American Idea.
I'm glad to do it, Jeff.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcast, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.